It's 4:06, and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later in the show, we'll look at a new report on an epidemic of domestic violence against women around the world. And we'll catch up on the latest Wisconsin news with Noah Ovshinsky. First, it's time for Food Friday. Strawberries are in season. They're all over the place. I usually just eat them straight up, but some people are more creative than I am.
And I am a self-confessed strawberry fiend. I will go to the ends of the earth for a good strawberry shortcake.
But one of WPR's in-house foodies, Lori Skelton, has started using strawberries in, wait for it, savory recipes, not the sweet stuff, like the risotto we posted on our Facebook page earlier this week.
And she's here to explain how we can think about strawberries differently in the kitchen. Lori, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
So strawberries, this is a special fruit for you. Yes, this is not your run-of-the-mill apple. What's special about strawberries
to
you?
Your birthday was yesterday. Mm-hmm. My birthday is next week and falls right in the middle of strawberry season in Wisconsin. So I think I have had more birthday strawberry shortcakes than I've had birthday cakes
and that's a good
in
thing.
My entire life. So yeah, strawberries do mean a lot to me. I love them.
Now, this spring has been cool and wet around the state. And you talked to someone at the farmer's market about how this affected the strawberry crop.
When I bought strawberries at the farmer's market last week, one of the two vendors I got strawberries from was from Singing Fawn Farms. And he had some good things to say about the rain.
The nice thing about it is I haven't had to turn on my irrigation. I'm in very sandy soil, and actually the timing of the rain has been very, very beneficial for the strawberries themselves. The added benefit for people that live in Wisconsin is that because of the cooler weather, it made the flesh of the berry a lot more meatier or thicker, so we don't have those big hollow strawberries like you get from California. These are just as big, and they're nice and heavy and thick.
And the berries I got last week were nice and firm. Lovely.
Excellent.
I can vouch for that. I got to say, first of all, happy pre-birthday.
Thank you.
Secondly, thank you because you've been bringing around this divine strawberry taste sensation stuff in the hallway on this giant roving cart. Strawberry salsa was the first one. Tell us about that recipe.
Well, what I found out years ago when I actually was looking for ceviche recipes, somebody told me, think about strawberries the way you think about tomatoes. They're both fruits. They're both sweet in their own way, and they both have a high acid content. So you can do a lot of things with them that are savory that you wouldn't necessarily think of until you try them. Strawberry salsa is a good example. You've had mango salsa, maybe. Mm-hmm. Well, here you've got the sweet playing off of the heat with the jalapenos. And the lovely thing about using strawberries with your jalapenos is they tend to bring the heat up the longer the salsa sits out. So you can really have a lot of fun playing with your heat levels.
Now, just thinking about strawberry salsa before I tried it, it didn't sound right. It's like over here is a dessert thing and you're throwing it into this, you know, this veggie dip. It worked. Why do those flavors come together so well?
We're playing more and more with sweet and sour combinations or sweet and something else combinations. We're learning that even with sweet, there are different levels of flavor. And here again, I love playing with sweet things and hot things. It's one of the reasons I love Thai food. And I think that's why it works.
Well, there was an unexpected benefit to the salsa, yes. It created a little runoff that became something good.
Strawberries do tend to get a little more watery than tomatoes do. So what I discovered is if you make your salsa earlier in the day and you want to drain off that liquid, it's really good added to tequila. So if you want to jazz up your margaritas, you make your salsa, you make your drink, you get creative.
I will note that we have not sampled this at the workplace. Yes. We haven't put that to the test.
This is only
but the weekend
secondhand.
Is coming. The weekend is coming.
Well, you did not stop. You could have stopped and been satisfied at strawberry salsa, but you did not stop there, Lori, did you?
Well, strawberry risotto is something that I discovered a couple of years ago. One of those recipes I looked at and thought, are you kidding me? Really? Strawberry risotto? It works beautifully as an accompaniment to, say, pork or duck. And again, we've got pictures on the Facebook page. We've got the recipe on the Facebook page. While there's a little sugar in the recipe, that's more to draw out the juices, to break down the flesh of the berries as you're stirring. It doesn't taste sweet. There is a little wine in the strawberry risotto. And I think one of the things the strawberries do is it adds these, again, layers of flavor. And here it's layers of flavor on the low end. It gets very, very deep tasting.
Well, yeah, and we've been trying this around the offices. And the most common comment I've heard is, if I didn't know it was called strawberry risotto, I wouldn't necessarily have said there are strawberries in it.
Right. Somebody actually said it reminded her of beef bourguignon. Now, she may have been a little more sensitive to the wine in the recipe,
maybe.
but we're definitely playing off the umami. We're definitely playing off the savory thing here.
It's an interesting thing, isn't it? Because when you proposed this segment and they said you wanted to do savory things with strawberries, I thought it was blasphemy. You're taking this perfectly beautiful desserty fruit and doing these savory things with it, but you've opened up on the other world. You've cracked open this whole other world of flavors and combinations.
And of course, you are right. When you get a strawberry and it's that perfect, lovely red little globe in your hand, no, you don't want to do too much to it. But if you've had your strawberries for a couple of days and they're starting to get a little bit mushy, I mean, they're perfectly good, but you may not want them for the dessert when they're the centerpiece. Using them in a salsa or a risotto or a ceviche, this way the appearance doesn't matter. All that matters is that full flavor coming through.
Mm. Well, and Lori, we know this, we know it's tasty. I stand by that. But if you had to choose one last strawberry meal for your last meal, and that's it, do you go for the sweet or do you go for the savory?
If I had strawberries for my last meal, I would have unadulterated strawberries.
Straight
up. Perfect Wisconsin strawberries.
Purist.
Because when it's a good Wisconsin strawberry, there's nothing better.
I agree. And you can tell it's good because you bite in and it's red
all the way through.
Yeah.
Yes.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Well, Lori, we really enjoyed eating the risotto and the salsa. Make them anytime for us. And thank you so much for joining us.
I am looking forward to cooking a lot on Central Time.
Excellent.
That was Lori Skelton, one of Wisconsin Public Radio's in-house foodies. And you can see her strawberry salsa and risotto recipes on our Facebook page.
Strawberries, what kind of fruit should we work with next, Veronica? Should we put on the... I'm a mango fan.
Mangoes.
It's not a local food, obviously, and they're hit or miss, but maybe some mango cooking when they're in season, whenever that is. I don't even know.
Yeah, I can't even think of what you would do with mangoes besides chutneys, but that's a pretty darn good start. Well, desserts. You could do mango desserts.
So we'll issue that challenge to Lori for next time. Well, coming up next, we're going to talk about a new report that says a third of women worldwide are victims of domestic violence. Stick around for that. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up Monday on the Joy Cardine Show, Cynthia Schuster will speak to two lawmakers about their reactions to the Wisconsin budget and the state capitol report. That's coming up Monday at 7:30 on the Joy Cardine Show.
And now here's a look at some of the latest news with Kristen Durst.
Thanks. Republicans have said they don't see any major obstacles to confirming James Comey to head the FBI. President Barack Obama announced his choice today. Comey is a former federal prosecutor who has also served as an executive at Lockheed Martin. He was the second-ranking official at the Justice Department under George W. Bush. The Food Network has announced that it will not be renewing TV chef Paula Deen's contract. The announcement comes days after it was revealed that she admitted using racial slurs in the past. While questioned last month in a discrimination lawsuit, the Food Network star admitted to having used racial slurs, but insists she and her family do not tolerate prejudice. Forecasters say Wisconsin is in for another round of severe thunderstorms overnight. A line of storms raced across the state early this morning, dumping heavy rain and causing power outages. Storms tonight into tomorrow morning could pack winds of up to 60 miles per hour.
Thanks for the news, Kristen. You can catch more news coming up at 4:30. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Yesterday, the World Health Organization released a stunning report on global levels of domestic violence.
The report said that a third of all women around the world suffer from domestic violence, and the head of the World Health Organization has called it a global health problem of epidemic proportions.
Later in the hour, we'll speak with Mayanna Molman of Amnesty International about how the U.S. government may try to decrease these numbers. First, though, Dr. Claudio Garcia Moreno of the World Health Organization joins us from Geneva. Claudia is a physician and the leader of this recent study. Thank you for joining us. And Claudio, do we have you with us? And Marianne, are you there? Let's see. Well, we're going to check up what's going on with the guests here.
I am here.
Okay. And this is Claudia, correct? Mayanna.
No, this is Mayanna.
Mayanna, thank you so much. Thank you for bearing with us there. What new information came out of the study that the WHO released yesterday?
I think what's really important about the study is that it confirms what human rights organizations have known for a long time, which is that women are beaten up in their homes in every country in the world, and that this is a much more widespread problem than most people think. We sort of like to think that it's something that happens to other people in other countries, but it is something that's very prominent in every single country in the world. And the other thing that the report says is that this is a health problem. This is something that affects women's health. And this is something that affects the health of our communities. And I think that that's an important message for us to hear and do something about.
Now, these numbers, they were dire. Were you expecting numbers like these?
I have to say that, unfortunately, I was not surprised. I have seen similar numbers coming out of specific countries. Perhaps what's not so wonderful to learn is that this was such a global epidemic, but I wasn't surprised, and that's maybe sad for me.
And I wanted to bring with the other guest who we were not able to get on before. She's with us now, so we'll talk to you both at the same time. Claudio Garcia Moreno, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And we were just talking with our guest, Mayanna Molman, about the direness of these numbers. These were shocking numbers that came out yesterday. From your perspective, as someone involved in the study, tell us what you found. What was most striking to you here?
Well, I think that the main message of the report is that it is a very widespread and global problem, and that wherever we look at it, whatever region we look at it, even though there are some variations, the numbers are just unacceptably high.
And the shocking, one of the other shocking things is that this is violence of intimacy, largely, isn't it?
Yes, the most common form of the two forms of violence that we looked at was by far violence in the hands of husbands or partners. We also looked at homicide statistics, again, across the globe, and we see that of the women who were murdered, 38% were murdered by intimate partners. These also are very shocking figures.
38% is astounding. Now, I imagine that this varies by region. Are there areas where this is more acute?
Well, we know that among the women who are abused and who are murdered, so the main perpetrators of these murders are partners. And these numbers, this is the global number that we have. And there are, again, some variations, but there are also big variations in the quality of the data that is available.
What do we need to do to collect the most accurate data as we're looking at this? Because clearly this is something that needs to be watched and closely.
Well, the first thing that I would emphasize is that we have made a lot of progress in terms of the data that is available. Only 10, 15 years ago, we really had data from only a handful of countries. Now, for this study, we found data from 81 countries for partner violence. And for 56 countries for non-partner sexual violence. And we see that from 2005 onwards, we have really many more studies, many more countries beginning to collect this information. And this is, it's a first step, but it's a way of naming the problem, of making it visible, of making it public. And we've seen in many countries that once the data is available, there's the momentum for action. And I think we see this, that these numbers, these alarming figures, we see them as a call to action, really, for governments across the world and leaders at all levels to take action.
And Mayanna, I know that's something that you're looking at with Amnesty International. What sort of action is Amnesty International looking at?
Well, right now we're pushing a bill that's hopefully going to be reintroduced in Congress in a couple of weeks. It's called the International Violence Against Women Act. This is a bill that has been introduced several times in Congress. It has yet to be voted on. But it sets out a comprehensive strategy for our foreign policy so that violence against women would be a priority for our foreign policy, so that ambassadors across the world, U.S. ambassadors, would need to, would want to, would have to take this up with their with the government in the countries that they're at. And it would also make sure that the money that's already appropriated for USAID could be used for programs to support victims of domestic violence, to support programs that lead to better prosecution and better data collection, the kind of data collection that Dr. Moreno was talking about.
Now, Claudia, I want to talk again about the health implications here, because we are looking at health. What are some of the things that result from the violence that we're seeing in this report?
Well, the report also looked globally at what data was available on the health effects of these forms of violence. And, for example, 42% of the women who have had experienced partner violence reported having had an injury as a consequence of the violence. We found that women who have experienced partner violence were twice as likely to have problems with depression, with alcohol use. They were 1.5 times more likely to have a sexually transmitted infection, in some regions HIV, more likely to have a low birth weight baby. So, again, when you look at all this information, it really highlights how big an impact, how big a toll this violence takes on women's health. We are also releasing, together with the report, guidelines for the health sector and for health providers in particular to address these forms of violence. And we see this, again, as a contribution to the solution, recognizing that this is a problem that will require action from many sectors, and health is only one. But we think that providers have an important role to play in responding to disclosure of violence, knowing when and how to ask, knowing what kind of clinical interventions are necessary, for example, following a rape, access to emergency contraception, access to prophylaxis for sexually transmitted infections, access to psychological support, mental health. We also are very concerned with the issue of prevention. How do we stop this problem from happening in the first place? How can we change the norms that in many countries still see this as unacceptable behavior, change the also high rates of abuse and maltreatment of children, because we know that children who are exposed to violence or who witness their parents abusing each other are also more likely to end up in an abusive relationship. And also issues of empowerment of women through access to education, to jobs, to other economic opportunities, which enable women to also leave abusive relationships.
And I think I read that, 600 million women live in countries where domestic violence is not considered a crime. How do you start affecting change when you're looking at a country like that, where it's not considered a crime?
Well, one of the things that we saw when we started doing some research in this work is that often, again, having the information helps to shape and to change laws. We saw, for example, when we did research 10 years ago in several countries, that in Thailand, for example, there was a discussion going on about a domestic violence bill, which initially had not included issues of rape within marriage. And the data that had been collected showed quite clearly that this was a problem, and this contributed to the law being changed and eventually being adopted with inclusion of marital rape. And we have seen this in several countries that where often women's organizations have been involved in using the data to advocate for changes in the law. We have seen recent changes, for example, in laws in India. And again, I would highlight that even though there is clearly a long way to go and clearly many countries that still need to move, if we go back to 1995, the Beijing Conference, and we look between now and then we can see that a significant number of countries have changed their laws in that during that period. I would also emphasize that it's not just laws around specifically on domestic violence or on sexual violence, but also a range of other laws, for example, laws around inheritance rights for women, property rights, divorce, custody laws, which many times, again, limit women's options and emphasize, again, the discrimination and the second status of women. So we really need to look at this comprehensively. How do we address the issues of inequality that are often underlying some of these problems?
Now, this study just came out. What is some of the first action you plan to take with it?
Well, as I mentioned, we are releasing at the same time as we are highlighting the problem and, in particular, the health effects. We are also releasing guidelines, recommendations for health providers and health policymakers. Clearly, the data highlights that the health sector needs to engage with this issue, both as a public health issue and as a clinical issue. We need to improve the training. Certainly, when I went to medical school many years ago, this was not on our curricula, and it was not something that was ever talked about. And so even in clinical situations where you could have thought that this was an underlying issue, it was just something that we were not aware of, and we didn't have the knowledge to know how to address. So we are emphasizing the need for training.
I'm sorry, Claudia, we have to leave it there, but thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
We're discussing the World Health Organization's report released yesterday that a third of women around the world suffer from domestic violence. Are you or someone you know a survivor of domestic violence? Do you work with people who suffer from domestic violence? You could reach us at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing our discussion about global domestic violence rates. It's a public health problem that a third of all women suffer from. Our guest is Amnesty International policy expert Mayana Molman, and we're taking your calls now. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@wpr.org, or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Mayana, can you give us a sense of how domestic violence levels in the U.S. compare with levels elsewhere?
Well, in the U.S., it's pretty much the same. You know, the data we have pretty much shows the same level. So it, more or less, one third of women are affected. Now, that could mean that they have been affected by one incident or that they're affected over time. So it's sort of, you know, the data, as Dr. Moreno was saying before, is, you know, sometimes we don't have good data or we don't have comparable data. But it is a very prevalent problem in all of the states. And we don't have enough shelters in this country. Like, there's just not enough support for the victims.
Now, we talked earlier about the Violence Against Women Act that Amnesty International is hoping to move through. How do you see that working as the U.S. starts working with the international community?
I think, I mean, we already have a good sense of how it's going to work. Last year, the Department of State adopted for the first time a comprehensive strategy on violence against women. This was very much came from the sort of structure that's already set out in the International Violence Against Women Act, and they are implementing the strategy. The Department of State also set up a number of years ago the Global Office for Women. There's an ambassador at large that deals with women's issues, and this, again, is a structure that was borrowed from the International Violence Against Women bill that hasn't gone for a vote yet, neither of the houses. So, you know, you might ask, well, what do we need it for if we have already part of the structure? And the point is that this could go away, right? If Congress passes an act, however, this is mandated. Whoever is in the White House, we will have the structure in place. And that's something that's important to know for the continuance of the foreign policy, for the legitimacy of this as an act.
Now I want to ask you, just on a personal level, seeing these numbers that a third of women are victims of domestic violence, that if a woman is going to be murdered, the 40% chance is that it's her intimate partner.
Yes.
Why has it taken us so long to get a handle on this? And why has it been something that's been so hard to address for so long?
You know, I ask myself that all the time. I am also a human rights researcher. I have spoken to any number of women who have been subject to domestic violence and who have stayed in violent relationships. And sometimes, you know, when I talk to government officials, I see their eyes glaze over and they're like, well, we can't do anything about this. It's inevitable. It just happens. I think part of it is that we're not getting at the root cause, which has to do with the value of women and girls. We still value women and girls differently from boys and men. And I'm not sort of talking about treating everybody as exactly the same, right? Like, this is not a question of saying, oh, we're going to eliminate people's individuality. It is a question of saying, when we say somebody throws like a girl, we mean they do it badly. You know, when we say somebody is treated like a woman, we mean that they're treated in an inferior manner. And we need to eliminate that. I speak to so many women that feel that the only way they can get attention from their partner is when he beats them, right? Like women who will say, I know he loves me because he beats me. We need to eliminate that kind of thinking.
Well, Mayanna, thank you so much for joining us. It's powerful stuff, and I wish you luck. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Mayanna Molman, Senior Policy Advisor at Amnesty International.
Next up, we'll introduce a new segment and speak with one of our very own here at Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time. And now it's time for a brand new segment about, well, something old, or rather something well-remembered from the past. You might call it nostalgia.
This is something we're going to do regularly, and to set it up, we welcome in Chris Molina, one of our producers here at Central Time. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Rob. Hey, Veronica.
So, Chris, this was your baby, this nostalgia segment. Tell us about it.
Sure. Well, a little bit of background. I think the idea for this segment kind of came to me one day when we were sitting around the production office, and we were just kind of reminiscing about things, as we do from time to time, and we were talking about how when we were kids, we would put our tape recorders up to the radio and record songs onto a cassette. And, you know, surely there are better ways to acquire music even then, but, you know, now certainly there are definitely better ways to acquire music. But there was something kind of magical about that. There was this feeling of euphoria when that song that you really wanted on your cassette tape came on and you got it just perfectly and you didn't get too much of the DJ talking over the music. But, you know, so I found myself feeling very nostalgic about that, and it kind of got me wondering what other people are nostalgic for. So I started asking some colleagues around WPR what they missed, and, you know, I expected them to say, you know, I'm nostalgic for something, or, oh, I miss such and such, but what I really got is, like, some incredible personal stories out of these people. And what I'm really hoping to do with this segment is to bring these stories out and hear them and put them on the radio. And I really want to expand this beyond just the WPR people here on staff that we talk to. I'd really love to talk with you, the listeners, and hear what you're nostalgic for. What's great about nostalgia, you can be nostalgic for a time, a place, a thing, even a person. And this week, Veronica, you actually talked with Rebecca Dopart, who's here on staff at Wisconsin Public Radio. She's nostalgic for a thing, but also a time gone by. Let's take a listen.
I miss having just one phone in the house and one phone in my life, actually.
Amen. You know, I didn't realize how much I missed it until I started thinking about it for this segment. What is it that you miss about having just the one landline phone?
Yes, it's just it removes so much. Well, it leaves a lot of questions, but it also removes a lot of guesswork. You know, when I was a kid, we had one phone and it was mounted on the wall in the kitchen. So you always knew where it was. You didn't lose it. It always had power, mostly. And when you called other people on their landline phone, it was either busy or it wasn't. And there was no answer machine and no call waiting. So just all of this guesswork about, is someone avoiding my call, or am I catching them, you know, at a bad time, or can I leave a message? All of that guesswork is taken out of the equation. And I just kind of miss that simplicity of it.
Yeah, there is no ambiguity.
Right.
Either they're there or they're not.
They're,
but
yes.
Don't you find also that from that time, it wasn't an option to answer the phone? If it rang, it meant it was important. And
oh,
so,
absolutely.
Of course, you answered it. And now everyone screens all the time. And
yes.
Probably 80% of the time, they're there.
Right.
They just don't want to pick up.
Yes. The way I think, when I'm thinking back to my house, it was a huge deal when the phone rang. In fact, we would scramble to get it. It would be like, who's getting the phone? The phone. Hello.
Right. People would scream, the phone.
Yeah.
The phone.
People would get up from their chairs and walk over to the kitchen. My brother and I would often fight for who was going to answer it. It wasn't an option that you wouldn't answer it. It was actually sort of sad if you weren't there when someone called. So Now it's just totally optional. And if someone calls during dinner, for example, we just don't answer it. And several other times of the day, we just don't answer it.
And did you get worried when someone didn't answer?
Oh, yes, because then you never knew who it was. You would never, ever know who it was because there was no caller ID.
That was great when you wanted to call a boy.
Yes, absolutely.
And you chickened out. You could go click.
Oh,
no,
totally.
One ever knew.
You could even chicken out when they said hello.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could hang up and they wouldn't know it was you.
That's a whole other thing, like prank calls.
Oh, yes. Right. You really can't do that anymore
without
getting caught, at least. That's
do you
right.
think it's, you know, it's more about just like things being simple, right? You have a phone. It's plugged in. You answer it or you don't.
Yep.
Do you think you're nostalgic for stuff that's simple?
I'm nostalgic for stuff that's simple, for sure. And also just that ability to escape, because now that you can be found anywhere or someone expects you to be on all the time, you just don't have that escape like you used to. You used to be able to just, you know, go to the mall and be there without being able to be contacted. Or in the negative of that, you know, I often think of when I am trying to meet someone at a restaurant or the mall or, you know, a business or a play or something, and you just now text and say, I'm over here by the planter. And like in the old days, you would just wait and look around. And you usually found the person, but, you know, but not always. So I do miss the simplicity. I realize that certainly safety is a huge benefit of having phones now. But I don't like the ability to be contacted all the time.
Although when you gave that example about the planter, it also made me think of how in those same lovely, simple bygone days, there were times when I thought, my kingdom for a phone that travels with you.
Yes.
You know, where you thought, this tragedy could have just been averted if only I had a phone.
Absolutely.
You know, instead of a payphone or a landline.
Absolutely. I do remember being a kid and thinking, wouldn't it be cool if we had a phone that you could take with you? And, you know, even when you had one in the car and it had a big cord, that was, like, cool.
And they were, like, the size of giant boomboxes.
They were. But they were awesome. And they last. I think your power time on it was, like, 2 minutes or something. And also I remember dreaming about having a TV you could hold in your hand.
Oh,
and
radical.
That just makes me feel so old saying that. And I don't feel that old otherwise, but it's just like, wow, now my kids have TVs, you know, all kinds of devices that are like TVs in your hand.
Yeah. I don't know. So if you could go back, would you?
Yes.
You would?
I would. I would give it up. I would give up the convenience, and the safety would be the hardest to give up, especially with kids, because I like that part of it. But I think the world has gotten so hectic and busy, and just life is so busy and there's so much stimulation. I feel like we're all overstimulated all the time and it's so hard to find that place of rest. And cell phones are a big contributor, I think, to that craziness. As much good as they are, I think it'd be great to just have one landline on the kitchen wall.
Yeah, well, I think that ship sailed.
Yes, I think so.
But thank you so much for talking about it anyway.
Yeah, thank you.
Rebecca Dopart is on staff here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
And now it's your turn. We want to know what you're nostalgic for. Let us know on the Central Time Facebook page or email talk@WPR.org. Chris, thanks and get back to work.
All right. Thanks, guys.
Coming up, we'll check in with WPR news guy Noah Ovshinsky to see what's happening around the state. I'm Veronica Rickard.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Monday afternoon, it's At Issue with John Munson. After 3, his guest talks about the damage done by siblings who are bullies.
And here's a check of the latest headlines with Kristen Durst. Kristen, take
Thanks.
It away.
An agreement to vastly increase fencing patrols and high-tech monitoring along the U.S.-Mexico border has been formally unveiled in the Senate. The measure, backed by Democrats and Republicans, is an amendment to a sweeping immigration bill that, with the amendment, now looks headed for passage next week with substantial bipartisan support. The amendment would double Border Patrol agents at hundreds of miles of fencing and spend billions on everything from helicopters to drones to watchtowers. Flooding has forced the evacuation of the entire downtown area of the western Canadian city of Calgary. The region has been inundated by overflowing rivers that washed out roads and bridges and soaked homes. In Calgary, the waters have reached the 10th row of the city's hockey arena. Governor Scott Walker staying mostly quiet about what he may veto in the state budget, although it is unlikely he'll touch his top priorities, including a $650 million income tax cut, expansion of private school vouchers, rejection of federally funded Medicaid expansion, and a tuition freeze at UW.
You'll hear more news coming up at 5 o'clock.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. It's a big week for Wisconsin news with the state budget on the governor's desk.
Assistant News Director Noah Ovshinsky joins us now. Noah, welcome back.
Hey, it's good to be here. Thank you.
And we just heard Kristen mention in the news that budget. There's a lot there. Let's do a little lightning round, Noah, and hit some of the highlights.
I like it. Really, the question, Rob, is what wasn't passed in this budget?
Right, actually? Yeah. Almost everything was in there. So hit us. What was the kitchen sink here?
Well, first of all, it was a $68 billion two-year budget, and I'm just going to go through just a brief list of some of the things. I think it's worth noting that this budget affects most, if not all, Wisconsinites in one way or another, whether they're a parent, whether they're a child, whether they're a taxpayer, whether they're a homeowner. Everybody is touched in this budget. Firstly, as Kristen alluded to, this budget expands the state's voucher program beyond Racine and Milwaukee and takes it statewide. So that's a huge change, really a sea change in education here in Wisconsin. It increases per pupil funding a little bit by a few hundred dollars over the next 2 years. So people who are, of course, big supporters of public education like to see that kind of per pupil funding increase. Mm-hmm. Also, as Kristen mentioned, income taxes. We are all going to get a break. Depending on how much you make, we're going to maybe get an income tax cut of, on average, $150 per taxpayer.
And now none of these were uncontroversial, and that tax break has some people worried. I mean, it's factored in. There's going to be some structural debt there in part because of that, right?
Yeah. In fact, this is actually what was passed was twice the amount that Governor Walker had initially proposed, and they increased the amount of the tax cut largely based on revenue projections, new revenue projections that legislators received, essentially estimating that the state would bring in more money than was previously expected. And the assumption is that money, which hasn't happened yet, but the money that's projected to come down the pipe will help pay for that tax cut.
And now we're talking income taxes here. How about property taxes?
Yeah, it's interesting. It basically freezes any property tax increases this year. I would also mention that for parents who send their kids to private schools, there is also $30 million in this budget to pay for income tax savings for them. So it's also a bit of a tax break for those parents.
And the argument there being, if I'm one of those parents, I'm saying, why am I paying taxes and then to pay for public schools and then paying again for private schools?
Exactly.
Gotcha. And speaking of education and freezing things, the tuition at the University of Wisconsin.
Yes, the ever controversial issue of tuition freezes here in Wisconsin. This budget, I'm sure much to the delight of students and the parents, freezes tuition for the next 2 years for the entire University of Wisconsin system.
And the university, some spokespeople, it seemed like we're getting on board with this tuition freeze, if I read that right.
Yeah, several university officials say that they had expected that this would be the case. You know, there was some uproar some weeks ago about the amount of surplus money that the UW system has at a time when they have, you know, increased tuition over the course of several years. That was very controversial, and as a result, the legislature decided to freeze tuition.
Now, the other big ticket item that got a lot of attention, a lot of controversy, Medicaid and Badger Care. What ended up happening with that in the budget?
Okay, basically what happened, like several other states, there are several states who decided to accept Medicaid expansion under Obamacare. Mm-hmm. Basically, the Obama administration was offering hundreds of millions of dollars to states in order to pay for Medicaid increases. Basically, what Governor Walker and legislators did was reject that, and essentially means that about 90,000 Wisconsinites, by rejecting that Medicaid money, they're going to move those about 90,000 Wisconsinites off Badger Care and move them into the private insurance market. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, proponents of this will say that this will ultimately save money. Governor Walker himself has said that as a state, we can't rely on the federal government to pay for Medicaid. Critics will say that the people who have been moved off of Badger Care can't afford to pay for private insurance, even with help from the federal government.
And then there were some items that aren't as pocketbooky, but still, as always, made it into this budget. The Milwaukee local residency rule, where that was argued pretty hotly through this thing. Where did that end up?
Yeah, it's very controversial. And basically what this budget does is it loosens residency rules for people who work for local governments, like the one in Milwaukee, like the one you mentioned. Of course, there are exemptions for people who work in public safety. I believe there's a 15-mile rule with that, but it does loosen residency rules, and that's something that many legislators were hoping to do with this budget.
And then give us a few more of the highlights that came out of the budget.
Yeah, the other thing I'd mentioned is this budget requires police to collect DNA from people who are arrested for a felony. Not arrested, or I should say not convicted,
right,
but arrested. Of course, proponents of this will say that this is good for public safety, that the more police and law enforcement, the more access they have to this kind of DNA, the better. Of course, there are critics, many of them from sort of the people who like, you know, their rights and they individual rights. And they'll say, well, an arrest is one thing. A conviction is a complete other thing. And they argue that if you're arrested and released, it will be hard to get that DNA tossed out of the government system.
Looking ahead on the budget, Assembly passed it, Senate passed it, both pretty quickly. Governor Walker has it. What's his deadline?
Yeah, he's got a few days to pass it. His goal, in fact, he has to pass it by June 30th, by the beginning of the next fiscal year, which is July 1st. So he'll take the next week and decide what vetoes, if any, he would like to make. And of course, in Wisconsin, governors have enormous veto power. They can veto provisions. They can veto amendments. They can take out words.
They can cut a number.
They can cut a number. They can change a no to a yes and a yes to a no. So we'll see what that means over the course of the next week.
Now, looking around the state, moving away from the Capitol, some big news on frac sand mining.
Yeah, it is. There's a county, Pepin County, in western Wisconsin. For the first time, a county has voted to completely ban frac sand mining from an area. This is the first time. Now, of course, moratoriums have been mm-hmm. passed, which are by nature temporary. This is the first time a county has voted to ban frac sand mining outright.
And that's along a stretch of the Mississippi River.
Yeah, about 12 miles, which is heavily dependent on tourism. And the county supervisors passed this ban basically saying that, in order to protect tourism, in order to protect this area, we need to make this change.
And just a brief update. Mike Simonson last week talked about that iron mine in the Gugubic, the GTAC mine. What's new on that this week?
Yeah. One big thing. They filed an intent to mine, which I now kind of sounds like a technical term, and it is. But really, by filing this intent to mine, basically it's the beginning of this process by which this mine will eventually be approved and constructed.
That's a story we're going to be following here on the Ideas Network for a while. Noah, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Noah Ofshinsky is our assistant news director. Thanks so much for listening to our program, and now let us know what you think.
Send us your thoughts about the new show and your suggestions. You can email listener@WPR.org or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Then tune in July 1st to hear us 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, 3 to 6.
Our producers are Chris Molina, Amanda Magnus, Galen Druk, and KP Whaley.
Michelle Good is our board operator, and Cheryl Gasser is our executive producer. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.